content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the December 25th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Paris climate talks yield historic deal. What happened? World leaders from 195 countries reached a landmark agreement at the UN Climate Summit in Paris last weekend, ending a decades-long search for a global accord to reduce carbon emissions. This is a truly historic moment, said UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. The accord is a health insurance policy for the planet. Reached after 13 days of intense negotiations, the agreement binds together voluntary pledges by individual nations to limit their carbon emissions. Unlike previous agreements, it requires commitments from leading emitters China and India, and includes a provision for the world's wealthiest countries to give poorer nations at least $100 billion a year to help them adapt to climate change. Compliance won't be required by international law, meaning the deal does not have to be approved by the U.S. Congress. The stated goal of the agreement is to limit the global temperature increase above pre-industrial levels to 2 degrees Celsius, that's 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, the point at which scientists believe the destructive effects from climate change will become truly dangerous, and to pursue efforts to limit the rise to just 1.5 degrees Celsius. While the current commitments would keep the increase closer to 3 degrees, countries will reconvene every 5 years to update their pledges. Climate activists greeted the deal with expressions of relief and optimism. This is a tremendous victory for all of our citizens, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. Not for any one country or bloc, but a victory for all of the planet and for future generations. Republicans, however, were scornful. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell accused President Obama of making promises he can't keep and vowed that if a Republican is elected president, the deal would be shredded in 13 months. What the editorial said. Now comes the hard part, said the New York Times. The Paris Agreement doesn't solve the problem of climate change by itself, but it does provide the foundation for future efforts. How successful those efforts are depends entirely on whether governments fulfill their promises and promote investment in carbon-reducing technology. For now, let's celebrate the world's new sense of shared responsibility. The moment to be wariest of political enthusiasm is precisely when elite opinion is all lined up on one side, said the Wall Street Journal. So it is with Paris. China and India will stick to the deal only if it doesn't impede their economic growth. If the choice is lifting millions out of poverty or reducing CO2, poverty reduction will prevail, as it should. If climate change really does threaten the future of our planet, and we doubt it does, then the solution lies with human invention and the entrepreneurial spirit, not a gaggle of governments and the United Nations. The Paris Agreement is important because of the message it sends, said The Economist. It represents an unprecedented political recognition of the risks of climate change and of the urgent need for action. It's also an unmistakable signal to investors, oil companies, and the public that the age of fossil fuels has started drawing to a close. That should prompt more investment in green strategies and less in coal. What the columnist said. This is President Obama's biggest accomplishment, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. By using his existing regulatory power under the Clean Air Act, he imposed innovative new rules to curtail greenhouse gas emissions. He used that progress to leverage an agreement with China last year that broke the deadlock between the industrialized West and the developing world. Obama then cannily ensured the Paris deal didn't require the approval of the GOP, the only major political party in the world that still questions man-made global warming. If governments live up to their word and the green energy revolution continues its impressive progress, the climate accord should take its place as one of the great triumphs in history. But the whole agreement relies on magical thinking, said Christy Ashwanden in 538.com. Meeting the crucial 2-degree target will require leaving the majority of the world's unused fossil fuels, 80% of coal, 50% of gas, and 33% of oil, in the ground until at least 2050. Yet rather than confront this major issue, governments are instead pinning their hopes on negative emissions, the idea that we'll eventually develop technology that can remove large amounts of CO2 from the atmosphere. We already have the technology to address climate change, says James Konka in Forbes.com. It's called nuclear power. Building a new generation of reactors could fulfill almost half of the world's emissions reduction target. They're safer than ever, and their life cycle costs are now as good as natural gas. For the sake of the planet, environmentalists must drop their irrational opposition to nuclear. For the deal to mean anything, the private sector must take it seriously, said Chris Mooney in the Washington Post. Analysts had expected the clean energy transition to be gradual rather than radical, but Paris changed that dynamic. It puts the focus not just on cutting carbon emissions, but on developing new technologies to counter climate change. That will take massive investment, but it's the only sensible approach. Paris could be the start of a very new world. And a second main story this week, Republicans tussle over terrorism, immigration. What happened? National security took center stage in Las Vegas this week as the leading Republican presidential candidates sparred at the final GOP debate of 2015, and the first since the terrorist attacks in Paris and San Bernardino, California. While a highly anticipated showdown between frontrunner Donald Trump and second-place Texas Senator Ted Cruz, whom some polls show leading Trump in Iowa, never materialized, it was a contentious evening, with rivals clashing over who could best protect the homeland. Trump's most volatile exchanges were with Jeb Bush, who is languishing in the low single digits in national polls. The former Florida governor dismissed Trump's proposal to ban all Muslim immigration to the U.S. as evidence that the billionaire lacks seriousness. Donald is great at the one-liners, but he's a chaos candidate, Bush said, and he'd be a chaos president. Cruz, meanwhile, squared off with Florida Senator Marco Rubio, widely seen as the favored candidate of the GOP establishment. Casting Cruz as weak on terrorism, Rubio blasted the Texas senator's June vote in favor of the USA Freedom Act, which limited the National Security Agency's power to collect phone and other communication records in bulk. In the face of jihadist threats, Rubio said, "We need more tools, not less tools." For his part, Cruz bashed Rubio for sponsoring a 2013 bipartisan bill that would have offered a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. "He was fighting to grant amnesty," Cruz said. "I was fighting to secure the border." What the editorial said. The Republicans were full of bravado but little else, said USA Today. Trump uttered his usual empty platitudes about winning in strength. Cruz vowed to carpet bomb ISIS, but not in cities, as if fighters would march into the desert where they could be more easily dispatched. Senator New Jersey Governor Chris Christie tried to portray himself as the toughest candidate on the stage, boasting that he'd shoot down Russian planes that violated a Syrian no-fly zone, likely triggering World War III in the process. The debate exposed Trump's huge inadequacies for the job of president, said the Washington Examiner. His half-baked plan to thwart ISIS by closing the internet in some way suggests he doesn't have a clue how the web works. He embarrassed himself further by revealing that he didn't understand what America's nuclear triad is, even though other candidates had explained that the phrase refers to the nuclear weapons in submarines, airplanes, and missile silos. We have to hope primary voters will consider not only where candidates stand on the issues, but whether they have the slightest idea of what those issues mean. What the columnist said. Do issues even matter in this primary? Asked Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Cruz and Rubio engaged in a spirited and tough exchange on serious matters such as illegal immigration and ISIS. In a sane year, those two would be the front runners. But we live in a world where Donald Trump leads by up to 27 points in recent national polls. It seems the worse things get, and things have gotten worse after Paris and San Bernardino, the more GOP voters turn to the angriest, least rational person in the race. The Rubio-Cruz exchanges exposed the GOP's deep rift on foreign policy, said Michael Crowley in Politico.com. Rubio is a traditional interventionist who believes in toppling dictators like Syria's President Bashar al-Assad and promoting American-style democracy. But Cruz represents a growing conservative bloc suspicious of America's ability to reshape the world in its image. He would have no trouble working with Assad against ISIS. Clearly, it's not George W. Bush's party anymore. Cruz's entire candidacy is a challenge to establishment dogma, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. After Republicans lost in 2008 and 2012, party officials stressed that to win the White House, the GOP had to reach out to new groups, especially young people and minorities. But Cruz's ultra-conservative campaign is based on the theory held up by the party's right. The GOP lost those elections because it didn't nominate a truly conservative candidate who could motivate the base. The theory may finally get its test, but for Cruz, the nomination is not out of reach. While we're on this page, let me give you one short from the It Wasn't All Bad section. Donna Goldstein won a shopping spree on her birthday, but the 99-year-old California wanted nothing for herself. Instead, she used the opportunity to make well-stuffed holiday stockings for children in need, which she plans to distribute through her church. "I'm going to cry, I'm so happy," she said last week, as she filled her cart with toys and candy, along with essentials like toothbrushes and socks, at a 99-cent store in Beverly Hills. "I feel bad that I can't do it for every poor child," Goldstein said, "but it makes me feel very good that I am able to do what I can." Our controversy of the week: affirmative action. Should blacks go to, quote, lesser colleges? Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia is known for his acerbic wit and his commitment to an originalist reading of the Constitution, said Peniel Joseph in Newsweek. But we now know that he also harbors the kind of bold-faced belief in white supremacy thought to have ended with formal racial segregation. While hearing arguments in the case of a white applicant suing the University of Texas for its affirmative action policies, Scalia wondered aloud if UT ought to have fewer black students, and if blacks are better off at a slower-track school where they do well. Scalia's bigoted remarks are simply astonishing, said Steve Nelson in HuffingtonPost.com, and echo the separate but equal standard established by his 19th-century predecessors on the court. As Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid said on the Senate floor, It is deeply disturbing to hear a Supreme Court justice endorse racist ideas from the bench. Scalia may be the left's favorite boogeyman, but he said nothing racist, said Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. Scalia was merely alluding to research on academic mismatch and submitted to the court in a brief. That research does indeed suggest that black students with lower GPAs and SAT scores have higher dropout rates and lower grades when admitted to highly competitive top-tier colleges. Scalia's critics are intellectually blinkered, said Dan McLaughlin in TheFederalist.com. If the reality is that racial preferences are harming students, is that something we should not want to know? What raging hypocrisy, said Paul Campos in Salon.com. Scalia and the other conservatives never tire of reminding us that the Supreme Court's job is only to determine if laws are constitutional or not. But in this case, the court's conservatives would rather entertain all sorts of highly disputed speculation about the real-world impact of a law they plainly don't like. Scalia's suggestion that blacks are better off at lesser schools is not only offensive, it's wrong, said Emily DeRoy in NationalJournal.com. The studies he cited, cherished though they are by conservative opponents of affirmative action, were long ago debunked. What research actually shows is that graduation rates for black and Latino students double when they move to selective schools. They also get higher paid jobs after graduation. This case is far murkier than either liberals or conservatives will admit, said Jay Michelson in thedailybeast.com. Affirmative action is a form of racial discrimination, and the court has previously ruled in several muddled decisions that colleges can weigh race for the purpose of promoting diversity, but not too heavily. The University of Texas case landed back in the court for the second time because of vague evidence as to how race factors into its holistic admissions standards. The truth is that race-based admissions processes have grown as mysterious as the sorting hat from the Hogwarts. Given that uncertainty, affirmative action is a complex matter on which reasonable minds will differ, said John McWhorter in CNN.com. Though research on the issue is hotly disputed, a 2004 UCLA study conclusively showed that academically mismatched black law students were far more likely to fall to the bottom of their classes and fail the bar exam. A Duke University study found that black students studying math and science alongside whites with superior academic credentials were far more likely to become frustrated and leave those fields. If we're truly serious about giving young people of color the best possible start in life, we must consider all the evidence with an open mind. It was a good week for wearing shorts after new NASA figures showed that November was the warmest on record, 1.9 degrees Fahrenheit above the average for the month from 1951 to 1980. In December, temperatures are running 30 degrees above normal in the eastern half of the U.S. It was a good week for last-minute upgrades after app developers announced the upcoming launch of Cedaroo, a mobile phone marketplace that will allow airline passengers to pay other passengers to swap seats after boarding the plane. And it was a good week for Norway after the UN's annual Human Development Index rated the Scandinavian country as the world's best place to live based on life expectancy, education, and income. The U.S. came in eighth. But it was a bad week for privacy after Brigham Young University researchers revealed a new method for reading computer users' emotions by tracking how users move the mouse. Using this technology, websites can go beyond just presenting information, said researcher Jeffrey Jenkins. They can understand what you're feeling. It was a bad week for military preparedness after the U.S. Navy's newest warship, The $437 million USS Milwaukee had to be towed back to port due to a complete loss of propulsion just 20 days into its maiden voyage. And it was a bad week for getting carried away after a Houston man halted traffic on a busy freeway I-45 to get down on his knees and propose to his girlfriend. "I never really thought about causing an accident," said groom-to-be Vidal Valadares Navas, who faces a $2,000 fine and up to 6 months in jail. Love makes you do stupid things. And one of the Only in America blurbs: a Texas seventh grader was ordered to cover up his Star Wars t-shirt because it violated the school's ban on symbols oriented toward violence. Colton Southern was told to zip up his sweatshirt to conceal the image of a stormtrooper holding a laser blaster. "He's just a kid excited for the movie," said his father, Joe Southern. "It's political correctness run amok." On the briefing page, we have a seasonal topic titled "The Many Faces of Santa." Goblins, witches, horned beasts, the gift givers of Yuletide come in many different guises. There are other Santas? There sure are. Although Americans are accustomed to their gifts being delivered by the jolly, portly figure of Santa Claus with his big white beard and red suit, Christmas celebrators around the world welcome a multitude of gift-giving visitors during the holiday season. These alternative Santas range from St. Nicholas himself, the original inspiration for Santa Claus, to goat-like demons that threaten to drag naughty children down to hell. One increasingly controversial figure even sports blackface, but they all have the same mission: to assess whether a child has been naughty or good, and to dole out the appropriate punishment or reward. Are they all men? No, in Italy, presents are dispensed by a friendly witch called La Befana. In Italian folklore, Befana was asked to join the three wise men in their journey to Bethlehem to welcome the baby Jesus. But Befana, a meticulous housekeeper, spent too long tidying her home and ended up missing the big event. Devastated, the witch now wanders the earth on her broomstick in search of Christ, leaving gifts and candy in the stockings of Italian children as she does so. Naughty children get bags of ashes. Another popular Christmas figure in Europe is St. Nicholas, one of the main inspirations for countless gift givers, including Britain's Father Christmas and Santa Claus himself. What is St. Nicholas' story? St. Nicholas was an early Christian bishop born to wealthy parents in 270 AD in what is now Turkey. After he became bishop of Myra, Nicholas gave away his riches, in one case tossing bags of gold through a poor family's window to save three daughters from prostitution. When Nicholas died on December 6, 343, he was made a saint. Children across Europe still celebrate the anniversary of his death by leaving gifts for his white horse in exchange for sweets. In the Netherlands, Nicholas was called Saint Herr Nicholas, later shortened to Sinterklaas. The Dutch settlers of New York took the tradition to America, where the figure eventually morphed into the chubby, red-cheeked Santa Claus we know today with the help of advertising artists. In the Netherlands, however, children continue to look out for Sinterklaas, along with his notorious sidekick, Zwarte Piet. Why is Zwarte Piet controversial? Zwarte Piet, or Black Pete, has serious racist overtones. The character dates back to the Spanish rule of the Netherlands and arrives with Sinterklaas via steamboat in the run-up to St. Nicholas' feast day. on December 6. Zwarte Piet was first depicted as St. Nick's swarthy slave in Moorish dress, and now acts as his assistant, doling out sweets to good children while threatening to stick naughty kids in a sack and take them back to Spain. Played by a man in blackface, Zwarte Piet is a regular attendee at Christmas parades in Holland and Belgium, but this tradition has run afoul of modern sensibilities and may be on the way out. A Dutch court recently ruled that Zwarte Piet represented a negative stereotype of black people, and a Belgian minister for culture was denounced last week for posting a picture of himself as the character. "Now I'm an ordinary racist because I colored my face dark," responded Sven Gotts. "Come on, love, don't hate." Are all Santas Christian? No. Northern Europe is full of mythical creatures dating back to the pagan winter festival of Yule. The strangest might be Finland's Yule goat, or Julapukki, a goatskin-wearing figure who is said to live on Mount Ear, the country's version of the North Pole. Then there are the mischievous Yule lads, or Jolevenar, three naughty goblins with names like Door Slammer and Bowl Licker, who travel around Iceland handing out gifts and rotten potatoes. Icelandic children leave their shoes out for 13 nights running up to January 6th and wake every morning to find small presents left by Jólasveinar. As the festival and accompanying booze fest comes to an end, things get pretty wild, or so goes the myth. People come out of their graves, explains Iceland's native Hofi Steingrimdóttir. Seals take on human form, and cows develop human speech. Are there bad Santas? Yes, and they're increasingly popular. The best known is the terrifying Krampus, found in Central Europe's Alpine region. This horned, long-tongued demon has its roots in Germanic pagan traditions and Norse mythology, though today he often serves as the evil enforcer to the benevolent St. Nick's. On Krampusnacht, December 5th, adults dressed as the furred beast and race through the streets of Austria, threatening to whip children with birch sticks or chuck them in a sack and drag them to their hellish lair. "The Krampus is the yin to St. Nick's yang," says Jeremy Segers, organizer of the first Krampusnacht festival in Orlando. "It taps into a subconscious macabre desire people have that is opposite of the saccharine Christmas a lot of us grew up with." The Santa Cold War. Russians have their own version of Santa, and he has been dragged into the ongoing hostilities between President Vladimir Putin and the West. In 2008, Kremlin official Boris Gryzlov declared Santa Claus an illegal immigrant in Russia. He claimed the tubby American character was being used to inculcate Western values at the expense of Russian ones. "The motherland has its own superior gift giver," says the Kremlin, Ded Moroz, or Old Man Frost, a leaner, tougher alternative to the cookie-gobbler Santa. Originally a pagan Slavic winter wizard, Ded Moroz morphed under the influence of the Orthodox Church. Today, like Santa, he comes dressed with a white beard and big coat. But instead of frumpy Mrs. Claus, Moroz is accompanied by his beautiful granddaughter. Even his steeds are fiercer. Moroz flies in a troika pulled by three prancing foals so fast they've been known to race Soviet rockets into outer space. "No one will ever be able to take away Ded Moroz from Russia," said Gryzlov. "Not Santa Claus, nor any other imposters." Moving on to the columns, we'll take two from the U.S. today. The first, "When Facts No Longer Matter." what is true and what is not. Thanks to the explosive growth of the alternative information ecosystem, fringe views have gone mainstream, and the truth is whatever you prefer to believe. Do you believe that vaccines cause autism? That the elementary school massacre at Sandy Hook was a false flag operation staged by the government to promote gun control? That Sharia law will soon be imposed on the U.S.? You can find proof of these nutty notions on hundreds of websites, blogs, newsletters, talk radio shows, and partisan cable networks. A bogus video, erroneous chart, or phony story passed from peer to peer on Facebook often has more credibility than the mainstream media's attempts to correct the record. No one has exploited the post-factual era more expertly than Donald Trump, who routinely recycles crackpot information from the web's most feverish swamps. When caught in a lie, he shouts, "Media bias." He recently even claimed that members of the Muslim Brotherhood have infiltrated the Obama administration. Robert Mason, a University of Washington professor who has studied false information, sums up our new reality this way. If you say it loud enough or long enough, people will believe it. The myth of making it without help. Like Ben Carson, I used to tell audiences my life story to prove that hard work and determination can lead a black child out of poverty, said Isaac Bailey. But then I stopped telling that story. Instead of feeling sympathy for other people who start life at the bottom, audiences were turning my rise from destitution to professional success as an author and columnist into an indictment of those who are still mired in poverty. "You made it. Why can't they?" people would say to me. So I've learned to freely admit I'm not a self-made man. The handouts Carson scorns didn't make me lazy and dependent. They kept me alive through years when food was scarce. When my hard-working mom became disabled, we survived with the help of food stamps and government-issued cheese. I got free lunches at school. When my father died, I received Social Security benefits. Pell Grants helped me attend Davidson College. Should I be ashamed that I needed government help? Only if Mitt Romney and Donald Trump are ashamed of the small loans they got from their wealthy fathers to start their careers. No one, not even Ben Carson, makes it on his own. And this from France, uniting against the far right. "The far right must be growling, 'Curses foiled again,'" said Renaud Daly in Le Nouvel Observatoire from France. After the xenophobic National Front scored a record showing in the first round of French regional elections last week, leading in 6 of 13 regions, the party was denied victory everywhere. Turnout rose for the second round this week, a highly unusual occurrence, as voters headed to the polls just to stop the National Front. In some regions, Socialist Party candidates actually dropped out of the running and encouraged supporters to vote for the opposition center-right Republicans to prevent the far-right victory. Most disappointing for the frontist, the Le Pen family was shut out. Party leader Marine Le Pen, widely predicted to win the northern region of Nord-Pas-de-Calais-Picard, lost to a center-right candidate. Her niece, rising party star Marianne Michelle Le Pen, was also beaten in a southern province, Alpes-Côte d'Azur. This blunt rejection proves that, despite Le Pen's efforts to present a more mainstream face than her anti-Semitic father, party founder Jean-Marie Le Pen, the National Front is still not seen as an ordinary party like others. Most French voters recognize that it remains hostile to Republican values and bigoted against Islam. "Yet this election was still a victory of sorts for the National Front," said Alexis Brizet in La Figaro. The campaign was dominated by frontist themes of ending immigration and closing national borders, partly because the elections were held just weeks after the Islamist terrorist killed 130 people in Paris. So yes, the center-right and center-left have succeeded in creating a temporary dam to hold back Le Pen's swelling support. But make no mistake, the water level has not fallen. French political leaders are simply flailing, said Xavier Alonso in the Tribune de Genève from Switzerland. Socialists and Republicans prevented the National Front from taking control of a single regional government by joining forces. But how will that strategy play out in the 2017 presidential elections? If we want a real election with ideas, debate, projects, and ultimately a real choice, the two centrist parties will have to find some other strategy to delegitimize the National Front. The vote for president is too serious to be reduced to this farce of anything but Marine. Rather than marginalizing front voters, said Jerome Fenoglio in Le Monde, party leaders should address their concerns. Le Pen's followers are motivated by a feeling of powerlessness in the face of mass unemployment, injustice, and inequality. Socialists and Republicans must offer them some hope of vanquishing those ills, or voters will continue to shift to the far right. Similarly, the parties have to inspire the rest of our disillusioned, depressed electorate. Voters turned out to vote against Le Pen, but that just shows that we have failed to give them anything to vote for. We have an interesting title to our Last Word article this week. It says, English is not normal. It's a wonder English ever caught on, said John McWhorter, because it's weirder than just about every other tongue. English speakers know that their language is odd. So do non-speakers saddled with learning it. The oddity that we all perceive most readily is its spelling, which is indeed a nightmare. In countries where English isn't spoken, there is no such thing as a spelling bee. For a normal language, spelling at least pretends a basic correspondence to the way people pronounce the words. But English is not normal. Even in its spoken form, English is weird. It's weird in ways that are easy to miss, especially since Anglophones in the United States and Britain are not exactly rabid to learn other languages. Our monolingual tendency leaves us like the proverbial fish not knowing that it is wet. Our language feels normal only until you get a sense of what normal really is. There is no other language, for example, that is close enough to English that we can get about half of what people are saying without training, and the rest with only modest effort. German and Dutch are like that, as are Spanish and Portuguese, or Thai and Lao. The closest an Anglophone can get is with the obscure Northern European language called Frisian. If you know that cis is cheese and frisk is Frisian, then it isn't hard to figure out what this means. Brea, butter, in Griesen, tis is gut, Englisch, and goat, frisk. But that sentence is a cooked one, and overall we tend to find Frisian more like German, which it is. We think it's a nuisance that so many European languages assign gender to nouns for no reason, with French having female moons and male boats and such. But actually it's we who are odd. Almost all European languages belong to one family, Indo-European, and all of them English, and of all of them, English is the only one that doesn't assign genders. More weirdness? Okay. There is exactly one language on earth whose present tense requires a special ending only in the third person singular. I'm writing it. I talk, you talk, he, she talks. Why? The present tense verbs of normal language have either no endings or a bunch of different ones. Spanish, hablo, hablas, habla, and try naming another language where you have to slip do into sentences to negate or question something. Do you find that difficult? Why is our language so eccentric? Just what is this thing we're speaking, and what happened to make it this way? English started out as essentially a kind of German. Old English is so unlike the modern version that it's a stretch to think of them as the same language. Wat ugardina in gardegenum, pekadegenum prim gefrunon. Does that really mean, so we Spears Danes have heard of the tribe king's glory in the days of yore? Icelanders can still read similar stories written in the old Norse ancestor of their language 1,000 years ago, and yet, to the untrained English speaker's eye, Beowulf might as well be in Turkish. The first thing that got us from there to here was the fact that we were the Angles, Saxons and Jutes, and also Frisians, brought Germanic speech to England. The island was already inhabited by people who spoke Celtic languages, today represented by the Welsh and Irish, and Breton across the Channel in France. The Celts were subjugated but survived, and since there were only about 250,000 Germanic invaders, very quickly most of the people speaking Old English were Celts. Crucially, their own Celtic was quite unlike English. For one thing, the verb came first. Also, they had an odd construction with the verb do. They used it to form a question, to make a sentence negative, and even just as a kind of seasoning before any verb. Do you walk? I do not walk. I do walk. That looks familiar now because the Celts started doing it in their rendition of English. But before that, such sentences would have seemed bizarre to an English speaker, as they would today in just about any language other than our own and the surviving Celtic ones. At this date, there is no documented language on earth beyond Celtic and English that uses do in just this way. Thus, English's weirdness began with its transformation in the mouths of people more at home with vastly different tongues. We're still talking like them, and in ways we'd never think of. We're saying eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Have you ever felt like you were kind of counting? Well, you are. In Celtic, numbers, chewed up over time but recognizably descended from the ones rural Britishers used when counting animals and playing games, hickory dickory dock. What in the world do those words mean? Well, here's a clue. Hovere, dovere, dick were 8, 9, and 10 in the same Celtic counting list. The second thing that happened was that yet more Germanic speakers came across the sea, meaning business. This wave began in the 9th century, and this time the invaders were speaking another Germanic offshoot, Old Norse. But they didn't impose their language. Instead, they married local women and switched to English. However, they were adults, and as a rule, adults don't pick up new languages easily, especially not in oral societies. There was no such thing as school and no media. Learning a new language meant listening hard and trying your best. As long as the invaders got their meaning across, that was fine. But you can do that with a highly approximate rendition of the language. The legibility of the Frisian sentence you just read proves as much. So the Scandinavians did more or less what we would expect. They spoke bad old English. Their kids heard as much of that as they did real old English. Life went on, and pretty soon their bad old English was real English. And here we are today. The Norse made English easier. I should make a qualification here. In linguistics circles, it's risky to call one language easier than another. But some languages plainly jangle with more bells and whistles than others. If someone were told he had a year to get as good at either Russian or Hebrew as possible, and would lose a fingernail for every mistake he made during the 3-minute test of his competence, only the masochist would choose Russian, unless he already happened to speak a language related to it. In that sense, English is easier than other Germanic languages, and it's because of those Vikings. Old English had the crazy genders we would expect of a good European language, but the Scandinavians didn't bother with those, and so we now have none. What's more, the Vikings mastered only that one shred of a once lovely conjugation system. Hence the lonely third person singular S, hanging on like a dead bug on the windshield. Here and in other ways, they smoothed out the hard stuff. They also left their mark on English grammar. Blissfully, it is becoming rare to be taught that it is wrong to say, "Which town do you come from?" ending with the preposition instead of laboriously squeezing it before the WH word to make "from which town do you come?" In English, sentences with dangling prepositions are perfectly natural and clear and harm no one. Yet there is a wet fish issue with them, too. Normal languages don't dangle prepositions in this way. Every now and then a language allows it. An indigenous one in Mexico, another in Liberia, but that's it. Overall, it's an oddity. Yet, wouldn't you know, it's a construction that Old Norse also happens to permit, and that modern Danish retains. We can display all these bizarre Norse influences in a single sentence. Say, "That's the man you walk in with." And it's odd because, one, "thee" has no specifically masculine form to match "man." Two, there's no ending on "walk." And three, you don't say "in with whom you walk." All that strangeness is because of what Scandinavian Vikings did to good old English back in the day. Finally, as if all this weren't enough, English got hit by a fire hose spray of words from yet more languages. After the Norse came the French. The Normans, descended from the same Vikings, as it happens, conquered England and ruled for several centuries, and before long English had picked up 10,000 new words. Then, starting in the 16th century, educated Anglophones began to develop English as a vehicle for sophisticated writing, and it became fashionable to cherry-pick words from Latin to lend the language a more elevated tone. It was thanks to this influx from French and Latin, it's often hard to tell which was the original source of a given word, that English acquired the likes of crucified, fundamental, definition, and conclusion. These words feel sufficiently English to us today, but when they were new, many persons of letters in the 1500s and beyond considered them irritatingly pretentious and intrusive, as indeed they would have found the phrase irritatingly pretentious and intrusive. There were even writerly sorts who proposed native English replacements for those lofty Latinates, and it's hard not to yearn for some of these. In place of crucified, fundamental, definition, and conclusion, how about crossed, ground wrought, say what, and insay? But language tends not to do what we want it to. The die was cast. English had thousands of new words competing with native English words for the same things. One result was triplets allowing us to express ideas with varying degrees of formality. Help is English, aid is French, assist is Latin. Or kingly is English, royal is French, regal is Latin. Note how each one imagines posture improving with each level. Kingly sounds almost mocking. Regal is straight-backed like a throne. Royal is somewhere in the middle, a worthy but fallible monarch. Then there are doublets, less dramatic than triplets, but fun nonetheless, such as the English-French pairs begin, commence, and want, desire. Especially noteworthy are the culinary transformations. We kill a cow or a pig, English, to yield beef or pork, French. Why? Well, generally in Norman England, English-speaking laborers did the slaughtering for moneyed French speakers at the table. The different ways of referring to meat depended on one's place in the scheme of things. and those class distinctions have carried down to us in discrete form today. The multiple influxes of foreign vocabulary partly explain the striking fact that English words can trace to so many different sources, often several within the same sentence. The very idea of etymology being a polyglot smorgasbord, each word a fascinating story of migration and exchange, seems everyday to us. But the roots of a great many languages are much duller. The typical word comes from, well, an earlier version of that same word, and there it is. The study of etymology holds little interest for, say, Arabic speakers. To be fair, mongrel vocabularies are hardly uncommon worldwide. But English's hybridity is high on the scale compared with most European languages. The previous sentence, for example, is a riot of words from Old English, Old Norse, French, and Latin. Greek is another element. In an alternative universe, we would call photographs light writing. Because of this fire hose spray, we English speakers also have to contend with two different ways of accenting words. Clip on a suffix to the word wonder, and you get wonderful. But clip an ending to the word modern, and the ending pulls the accent along with it. Modern, but modernity, not modernity. That doesn't happen with wonder and wonderful, or cheery and cheerily, but it does happen with personality. What's the difference? It's that the F-U-L and L-Y are Germanic endings, while I-T-Y came in with French. French and Latin endings pull the accent closer. Tempest, tempestuous, while Germanic ones leave the accent alone. One never notices such a thing, but it's one way this simple language is actually not so. Thus, English is indeed an odd language, and its spelling is only the beginning of it. What English does have on other tongues is that it is deeply peculiar in the structural sense, and it became peculiar because of the slings and arrows, as well as the caprices of outrageous history. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in aeon.co. That's aeon.co. On the business page, the issue of the week, no end in sight for oil glut. How low can oil prices go? Asked Debbie Carlson in The Guardian. Crude prices dipped below $35 a barrel this week, the lowest level since the 2008 financial crisis, and further declines could be in the cards. The reason? The world is simply awash in oil, thanks largely to the U.S. shale boom and the decision by the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, to keep pumping at record levels. Meanwhile, El Nino is cutting into American consumers' demand for heating oil by delivering unseasonably warm weather across the country. Analysts still don't know how far prices might tumble. It's hard to call a bottom, said commodity broker Daniel Pavlonis. It's like catching a falling knife. The oil route looks to be longer, deeper, and far more costly than imagined, said Spencer Jacob in the Wall Street Journal. For the past year, Saudi Arabia has convinced its fellow OPEC members that pumping more crude, even as global prices fell, would help push U.S. fracking competitors out of business, since shale oil is often costly to produce. The strategy has been deeply painful for struggling OPEC members like Venezuela and Nigeria. But now the U.S. shale companies are beginning to feel the pinch of sustained lower prices. The Saudis smell blood, and earlier this month, OPEC members agreed to keep pumping at current levels. Still, it's a risky gamble. Iran has pledged to boost its crude exports next year as international sanctions are lifted, which will only add to the global glut. The International Energy Agency now expects the world to be oversupplied with oil through at least late 2016. That probably means more suffering for the U.S. oil patch, said Tom DeChristopher in CNBC.com. After a decade of steady growth, the once booming U.S. energy sector was the biggest job cutter of 2015. Energy companies laid off nearly 93,800 workers through November, up 700% over the same period last year. And at least 36 oil and gas producers filed for bankruptcy this year. That's led congressional leaders to throw energy companies a lifeline by agreeing to repeal the nearly 40-year-old ban on U.S. oil exports. The 1975 law was meant to combat skyrocketing oil gas prices triggered by the OPEC oil embargo that came in retaliation for U.S. support of Israel during the Yom Kippur War. Lifting the ban now, proponents argue, will save U.S. jobs and keep smaller energy companies from going under. Judging from the tone of the news coverage, you'd think the oil glut is unequivocally bad news, said Daniel Gross in Slate.com. But gas around $2 per gallon puts $100 billion extra a year into Americans' pockets, and they're using it to save money and pay off debt. That's not to downplay the risk of the oil patch's woes seeping into the broader financial system. Oil companies borrowed heavily to expand during the boom years, and that debt is now finding its way onto the balance sheet of pension funds, mutual funds, and even industrial investors. But even as we shed a tear for oil trading hedge funds that make ill-timed bets, we should share a smile for the typical American consumer who's enjoying the benefits of really cheap oil. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.